tonight on Arena. Harry McQueen on his new film Supernova, starring Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci, and Helen O'Hara on her new book Women vs. Hollywood. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The 2021 Virgin Media Dublin International Film Festival opens on Wednesday night with a screening of Supernova, a film by Harry McQueen. It stars Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci as Sam and Tusker, two gay men on a road trip through the Lake District in a Winnebago. Here's a clip where the two men stop at a roadside cafe and Tusker, played by Tucci, decides to have some fun with the waitress, now, while simultaneously embarrassing his concert pianist partner, Sam, played by Colin Firth.
Can I ask you, did you want one? An autograph? From him? Because I saw you looking at it. I wasn't sure if you wanted one.
Tusker?
No, it's all right. He's very shy. You know, normally, do you have a pen on you? All right, but if you want one, he'll sign one for you. He's shy, but he will. Either on a napkin, or if you have one of his piano albums, he'll...
Thanks.
Okay. All right, thank you. It's very nice of you, thank you.
How did you come to be this person?
I don't know. I don't even know why I do it, because it really isn't even satisfying anymore half the time, anyway.
So why do you do it?
Because of the other half.
Stanley Tucci as Tusker and Colin Firth as Sam in a scene there from Supernova, new film from Hinterland director Harry McQueen, who joins me on the phone now. I'm delighted to have you with us this evening, Harry. That gives us a real flavour of the sort of rapport between the two characters, Sam and Tusker. They know how to have a laugh together and clearly enjoy each other's company enormously. Just to introduce us a little bit further to the two characters, if you would, Harry.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me. Sam and Tusker are partners of 20 plus years. And Sam, as you said, is a concert pianist, and Tusker is a writer. And they're living with a diagnosis of young onset dementia. Stanley's character, Tusker, has been diagnosed with that. So they're kind of trying to negotiate life now with that diagnosis, so that the film sort of takes place with them on a road trip, sort of visiting people from their past along the way.
Yeah, this idea for Supernova, and I think the specifics of young onset dementia, there were a few different stories that actually you had come across in your own life that fed into this.
Yeah, that's correct. I think the first thing that happened was that about 6 years ago, I was working with a lady, a middle-aged lady, who, unbeknownst to me and her at the time, had young onset dementia. And over the course of a year that I worked with her, she changed hugely and eventually got sort of fired from our place of work. And a couple of years later, unfortunately, passed away. And so, you know, that was an incredibly moving experience to sort of watch that you know, firsthand. And at the same time, a friend of mine from back home put her dad in a care home when he was just after his 60th birthday. So those things happened, and I was really profoundly moved by them. So I then spent the next couple of years volunteering for dementia charities and learning as much as I could about it. And the story sort of is inspired by that, really.
Yeah, and the specifics, you won't want to go into too deeply, but that idea that there was somebody working with you, I mean, had people become impatient with her? Were they, you know, giving out about her all the time, and yet she was suffering in silence, really, while all of this was happening?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, she had a form of young onset dementia that's very similar to the one that the character has in the film, which actually kind of affects your motor skills and your eyesight and things like that before it affects things like memory. So actually she just got very bad at her job, and no one really knew why. And I think, you know, her diagnosis happened a little while after she left that place of work. Mm. So we were sort of unknowingly watching her kind of unravel with the dementia. Yeah.
The other thing I think that you saw, this possibly around the same time as both that lady's story, your former colleague, and indeed your friend's father, It was a documentary that you saw about a 65-year-old British man who went to the Dignitas Clinic in Switzerland.
That's correct, yeah. And that really, you know, deeply moved me, that whole situation. And I was really interested in end-of-life choices and the debate around that. And you know, I still am. I still think it's something that is, you know, really deeply important and, you know, something that we as a society maybe don't talk about, in my view, as much or as proactively as we should do. And actually what was interesting was that when I then spent a couple of years working very closely with people who are living with this kind of dementia, that topic came up all the time. So it seemed like a really important thing to weave into the story as well, because I think the two things are, you know, quite closely related.
The thing that's, I mean, yes, choices around death are part of the story here. Yes, young onset dementia is a very important part of the story here. But what's at the heart of this film, or what was at the heart of it for me at any rate, was the relationship between these two men, between Sam and Tusker, in this long-term gay relationship with each other. How important was the fact that it was a same-sex relationship? When did that become clear in the telling of the story?
It became really central to it quite early on. But my initial impetus was to write a heterosexual couple. And I sort of very quickly countered that and sort of wanted to ask myself why that was the choice that I instantly made. And in part, it was because I hadn't, you know, worked with anyone in the dementia world that was in a same-sex relationship. But it seemed to me that what we're dealing with, you know, as you said in the film, is a beautiful, organic relationship. You know, it's universal themes, love and of course death, but also, you know, trust and all of those things. And, you know, that sort of, you know, supersedes sexuality a bit. So once we've made the decision, it became a really central part of the story. And I think it's, you know, in its own way, because of that choice, it's quietly revolutionary, I would say, because the sexuality of the characters is absolutely irrelevant to the narrative in a way, and isn't mentioned, which I think is an original take on it for sure.
Yeah, it's just these two men who clearly love each other very, very dearly, and it's just two people who love each other very dearly. That's certainly what I found myself watching as much as anything else. Yeah. And the chemistry, and I know they're friends for a long, long time, Stanley Tucci and Colin Firth. The chemistry between the two of them, the ease between the two of them, is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, they're, it goes without saying, they're incredible actors. But also, you know, they love each other outside of work. You know, they've gone through a lot together over the 20 plus years that they've known each other. So I think that really helped. It really helped sort of, add the texture to the relationship. It certainly did help. Yeah.
Let's have a listen to another clip. They go on this long road trip together in the camper van, which is a great setting. And I'll come back to you. You seem to like the road trip side of things. I'll come back to that in a minute, Harry. But let's have a look. They arrive at Colin Firth at that character's sister's house, and they're going to spend some time there. And there's a question as to whether they're going to sleep in the camper van or go inside and sleep in the house. And this is the house where Colin Firth's character grew up. And here's the conversation between the two of them.
You always seem somehow to get your own way, don't you?
Oh, come on, it's cozy.
No, it's ridiculous.
No, it's not.
It's nice. Oh, you're in the middle of the fucking bed, isn't it?
I am on the edge. Now I'm more on the edge.
Are you okay?
That's it. I'm sleeping in the
No. Come on. Come over here. Come here.
Yeah, we'll move over a bit.
All right. Come here. I'll keep you. Come here. I'll be like a little rail for you, like kids have. There you go, bed rail. There we go. Is that better?
Just give me some. I can't breathe.
I was trying to stop you.
It is gorgeous where there they are in the single bed that Colin Firth's character kind of slept in as a growing up and as a teenager and all the rest of it. Yeah. Stanley Tucci has such, just even on a radio listen, he has such charm. It really adds to their relationship hugely.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, and I think it's really interesting that in the film you have a character as kind of gregarious and charming as Stanley, but also, you know, is dying and those things are being taken away from him. Mm. So it's quite an interesting juxtaposition in the film that I think he performs it absolutely, you know, brilliantly.
And while it's there, it's not a huge part of the relationship, but it's an interesting little, I suppose, quality that's added to it is the fact that the Stanley Tucci character has a background from America, as Stanley Tucci has himself, and the Colin Firth character is very definitely British.
Yeah, I think that certainly helps. I mean, I think you're always trying to make original work if you can tell original stories, and it certainly felt that if one of the characters was from another country, it would certainly change the energy of the central relationship, which I think it certainly does. Yeah, so it was exciting to watch that.
Yeah, I mentioned the fact that you seem to like road trips because your debut feature film Hinterland, which was so well received, you wrote it, you directed it, you produced it, you starred in it. And you made it on an iPhone for a small amount of money, as far as I'm aware. Was it a very different experience making something with two big stars like Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci in it, and some of the other actors that are in there as well, you know, well-known faces and names? Was that a very different experience from your debut?
In many ways, it was for the obvious reasons, that the money and the support and the team around the film, it very much was. But I think also, in a way, it really wasn't. It felt like a really small, intimate team. Everyone was very supportive, just as we were, on the first film. Hmm. So I think that atmosphere of, collaboration and warmth is something that I hope, to bring to all of the films that I'm, able to make if I get another chance to make.
I might get a chance to make another few, I would imagine. What about approaching names like Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci? Yes, you had the huge success, great critical acclaim for Hinterland. Did that open doors, or what made it possible to approach stars of that calibre?
To be honest, I don't know whether my first film did. I mean, certainly Colin and Stanley didn't know who I was at all, not as a filmmaker or an actor or anything. So I think really it has to... We had a great casting director, Shaheen Baig, so that was the first thing. And we got the script to Stanley, first of all. And I think really, to be honest, it just has to come down to whether the script chimes with the person you're giving it to. We're always looking for work, actors, and I think sometimes you read scripts that really, really that really move you and you think are important, and happily that happened on this occasion. You're always trying to hope that you're making stuff that's inspiring to people that you admire, and that definitely was the case on this occasion. So it was really the script that got me through the door with them initially.
And maybe tell me a little bit, Harry, about the ideas. I mean, the title of the film, Supernova, and the Stanley Tucci character, Tusker, loves to do a little bit of watching the sky at night and pondering upon the cosmos and the vastness of the universe. Where does that fit in with what is essentially, a small story of a couple going through a difficult moment in their lives?
I think partly for that reason, really, the kind of juxtaposition of the micro and the macro in the film is certainly what I was focusing on a lot. I mean, like you say, it's a small story, a small contained story, but you've got within that this little journey within a really big landscape. I mean, literally with the Lake District being the backdrop to it. But then on top of that, you've got someone and two people in this instance thinking about mortality and why they're here, and perhaps the bigger questions of what we're all doing, day to day. And I think it sort of made sense to weave in an element of the, of the cosmos to it, to sort of give it that, extra dimension.
Yeah, it gives it a bit of extra heft, right enough. Lovely to have spoken with you this evening, Harry. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much.
That's Harry McQueen, writer and director of Supernova, starring Stanley Tucci and Colin Firth, which will open this year's Virgin Media Dublin International Film Festival on Wednesday evening. Full information on diff.ie. The legend that is Nick Cave released a surprise album on Friday evening, a collaboration with longtime Bad Seeds member, composer, orchestrator and monthly instrumentalist Warren Ellis. The album is entitled Carnage. We'll be reviewing it this Friday, in fact. But in the meantime, here is the title track.
I always seem to be saying goodbye and rolling through the mountains like a train. My uncle's at the chopping block, turning chickens into fountains. I'm a barefoot child watching in the rain.
And that's Carnage, title track from the new album from Nick Cave and Warren Ellis. And we'll be reviewing that album in full on Friday night's programme. Arena, history was made at the Golden Globe Awards last night when Nomadland became the first film directed by a woman to scoop the Best Picture Award. The director, Chloe Zhao, also picked up the Golden Globe for Best Director, making her just the second woman to do so since Barbara Streisand won the Director's Award in 1984 for Yentl. In the post-awards press conference, inevitably, Chloe Zhao was asked about this historic achievement.
I mean, sometimes a first feels like a long time coming, isn't it? You feel like it's about time. And I'm sure there's many other before me that deserve the same recognition. I just love what I do. You know, I just really love it. And if this means more people like me get to live their dreams and get to do what I do, I'm happy.
Chloe Zhao there reacting to her success at last night's Golden Globes when her movie Nomadland became the first movie directed by a woman to win the Best Picture Award, and Zhao became just the second woman to pick up a Golden Globe for Best Director. Well, my next guest will not be at all surprised at the firsts involved in that list of awards. She is the author of a new book. The book is called Women vs. Hollywood, The Fall and Rise of Women in Film. Helen O'Hara, film journalist and editor-at-large of Empire magazine, is that author, and she joins me now from London. Well, it's the right day to be on talking about your book, isn't it, Helen, given last night's awards?
It really is. I'm so pleased for her because I've been, that's one of the things I write about in the book is the fact that awards matter to careers. And if it's only men who get nominated for these things, that really can hold women back in their careers. And it does affect, that they're the chances of getting their next film greenlit. So it's an enormously positive step. And it is depressing, like she says, that it's taken so long to come.
And awards do matter in careers. But as you tell us in the book, sometimes for a woman, the award happens and it takes a long time for that positive effect to kick in.
Well, I mean, this is it. Even somebody like Barbara Streisand, who was the first one to win, obviously, it still took her years to get her second film made. So and she's Barbara Streisand, for goodness sake, so it is a real issue. I think historically in Hollywood terms, basically women have been up against not just the fact that you have to be lucky anyway to have a career as a director in Hollywood. You have to be very good and you have to be lucky. But you also, they're up against this image that people have of directors in particular, that they are, this great driven artist, that they behave in a certain way, that they're very authoritarian. And people don't like women exercising authority and being very authoritarian. That tends to get people's backs up. So you get women directors either being described historically as, unbearable and difficult and, completely rude, or you get them described as a pushover and meek and not really knowing what they want. And it's been extraordinarily hard for women to walk the line between those two perceptions.
Yeah, I guess it might be a different use for one gender for authoritarian and for another authoritative,
Exactly.
It's a tiny difference, but it's a huge difference too. But it was not always so. And certainly if you go, as you tell us in the book, if you go back to the beginnings of Hollywood, it was a very different place initially.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. There was nobody really in the early days to tell you couldn't. So if you had a little bit of money and you could afford to buy a camera and a little bit of equipment, you could kind of set yourself up as a director. So some of the stories in the book, Alice Guy Blachet, who we think is the first woman ever to direct a film and is one of the first people ever to make a narrative film in about 1896. she started off in France, and you know, she made, you know, little films about that. That first one was about a fairy in a cabbage patch. Mm. But she went on to make at least 1,000 films, and she moved to the US and set up her own studio in New Jersey and was very successful for a while. And you have somebody like Lois Weber, who in the 1910s was one of the highest paid directors in Hollywood at all. Mm. Not just one of the highest paid women, one of the highest paid anywhere. And that's extraordinary. You know, we're still getting back to that.
But you mentioned that the French director Alice Guy there. That, do we ever hear her name anywhere close to mention of the Lumiere brothers?
No, we really don't. She worked mostly with Léon Gaumont, who owned, you know, the studio where she worked for most of her time in France. But she was literally written out of their official history when the time came to do that. So, you know, she kind of spent most of the last part of her life writing herself back into the history books, essentially.
The focus of the book, undoubtedly, though, I think it's safe to say, Helen, is the Hollywood, and it's women versus Hollywood. Was it really the star system and the studio system in the 30s and 40s that kind of cemented a really problematic relationship between women and film?
I think that's fair. Yeah, I think basically once the big money came into Hollywood, then almost all the female directors were pushed out. There were a couple that lasted during the studio era. But really, at that point, you were mostly left with women being stars, you know, or working in makeup and costume and things like that, obviously. And the stars were really interesting because their lives were very controlled by the studios. You know, you had studios telling stars who they could and couldn't marry. You had studios pressurizing women to get abortions at one point. You had, obviously, you know, stories, horror stories like Judy Garland being fed uppers and downers, drugs, basically, as a teenager to be able to work long hours and then sleep when they told her to, you know. So it really was sometimes quite horrific.
But obviously, I mean, in terms of the control that was exerted over the physical appearance, how different was it for women? How much more problematic was it for women? And you mentioned abortions. Obviously, only a woman could be forced into that situation.
Yeah. Yes. So that was something that the studios, obviously, you know, like many employers today, perfectly honestly, you know, they think, oh, women are just out to get me here and cost me money by getting pregnant, which is, you know, it's only the continuation of the species, guys. But yes, you're right. I mean, it was very much about controlling people's appearances. You know, they would do a bit of plastic surgery on some people. They famously raised Ava Gardner's hairline, or sorry, Rita Hayworth's. They just, you know, they would change you as necessary. They would change your name. And they did expect you to keep your weight down. For example, there was one story that I came across that some stars were given worms deliberately so that they wouldn't gain weight.
Mm. And has that changed, one would have to ask and wonder.
Well, quite.
Judy Garland, though, her story is particularly disturbing because of the involvement of her own mother.
Yes, yes. Her mother very much worked with the studio. She was very much one of these women who wanted her daughter to be a star and was really willing to do whatever it took to get her there. But then there was nobody, you know, at the studio side looking out for that or questioning that either. So, and they were pushing her to work those long hours, and they did object to her marriage, for example, when she got married for the first time at the age of 19. And she was one of the people pressured into getting an abortion when she became pregnant a year later. So, you know, that kind of treatment, you know, I mean, I'm not a doctor, but that has got to have contributed to her problems later in life.
And you also said the part of the problem here was the audiences wanted to see her as Dorothy. Yeah. That's what they wanted. They wanted Dorothy,
exactly.
The Wizard of Oz. They didn't want a woman who was growing into, you know, becoming a mother, et cetera, et cetera. But look, it all changed. So the wonderful 60s came along. Liberation came.
Oh,
women's
God.
Liberation came. The whole women's movement set in, and everything was set to rights. Yeah.
No. The weird thing is, really, I mean, if you look at the 70s in particular, which has this reputation as being such a daring decade in Hollywood and one that changed everything, and all of these new, young, exciting directors came in. But if you think about it, they were all men. And that's not because there weren't women trying to do the same thing. There absolutely were. There were women who had films shown in Cannes and who had written screenplays and who had, you know, funded their own independent films and gotten them made and were now coming to try and make something bigger on a studio level. And they just weren't allowed in the door. And this is the big difference. So Hollywood, even at that era, when it was all about new blood and new ideas, still wasn't letting women direct for the most part. So...
It comes back to this idea of the authoritarian authoritative again. There was just this feeling, how could a woman be an auteur? Was that simply that misogyny was there?
I think it was. I think it was a weird decade because there was a lot of misogyny and a lot of backlash against feminist ideas. So even when they did make a film about sort of the feminist movement, they had a man direct it and played it as a comedy. You know, they couldn't even see that a woman might have something to contribute then. And, you know, in that decade, you had incredibly talented women. Maya Angelou, the great African-American poet, wanted to direct one of her scripts that she'd written, studied cinematography so she'd really have a good case to show that she could do this. And they still didn't let her direct. She actually made her directorial debut something like 26 years later at the age of 70.
Wow. Amazing that it took that length of time.
Isn't it? You
talk about the Bechdel test, and I think people will know what we're talking about here. And so, you know, when you have two women in a scene, can they hold a conversation that doesn't mention a man or that doesn't, it isn't around a man? But I wasn't as familiar with the sexy lamp test.
Yes, I tried to gather all these different tests because Bechdel doesn't cover everything. So the sexy lamp test is essentially, could this role in a film, you know, could this woman's role be replaced by a sexy lamp? So it doesn't really do anything. It just sits there looking nice. And then there's a subtest is because sometimes there's a woman in a film whose job is to look, sit there and look beautiful, but she also explains one thing about the plot. So that's the sexy lamp with a post-it note on it.
Okay. You know. Yeah. And is it a test that unfortunately applies to many, many films?
You would be surprised and depressed, I think, how many films fail that test. You know, most Bond girls, for example, are either a sexy lamp or a sexy lamp with a post-it note.
Yeah. One of the things that you touch on here, and this is not confined, let's be honest, really, to the film industry, is the idea of the confidence that's needed in many jobs to put yourself forward and to lay yourself on the line. It would seem that in film, as in many other areas in the world, Barbara Streisand's boyfriend is a great case in point here about having self-confidence. Maybe tell that story so that we're not just making a general statement about it.
Yeah, so this was Barbara Streisand was dating a guy called John Peters, who had been her hairdresser when they met. And she was developing her version of A Star Is Born that she starred in with Kris Kristofferson in the end. And at one point during this development, John Peters suggested that he should direct the movie. And she was just sort of taken aback. It's like, how does he get this, the nerve, really, to suggest this? He's done, you know, he's done nothing along those lines. And it was that that got her thinking about directing Yentl herself and put her on that path to direct it herself. And again, it's striking, you know, that was dismissed as a vanity project because she was starring and writing, you know, and directing and everything. But, you know, when a man does it, that's described as him being passionate and multi-talented.
Yeah.
So isn't it weird that the ways that we talk about these things and the way that with the language that we use.
Film criticism, you worked in an office where I believe there were more people called in for a long time than there were women.
That is true. I mean, nothing against the Ians. They're all very talented. But yeah, I mean, that is the reality of I think, still film criticism. And so that is something I talk about in the book, because criticism, awards and festivals, you know, as long as those are all dominated by men, by male voters for the awards and male programmers for festivals, they keep choosing the same kinds of films. You know, it's all these war dramas for awards are far more likely to win than domestic dramas, you know. And we keep giving priority to these very male-driven subjects. And it's not to say they're not good and they shouldn't be there, but there should maybe be a slightly wider pool that we're drawing from, you know?
What about that idea around, you know, it came up last night at the Golden Globes, the idea of diversity across the Hollywood press. What about the representation of women within those who were making the awards, who were choosing the award winners last night, voting for them?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association is a very, very small group and extremely non-representative of the population. And that has, again, been a problem throughout. You know, most of the people who make decisions in Hollywood are not just white, they're straight, white and men, you know, so that affects whose stories get told as well. And historically in Hollywood, you know, the position for black people, for just people of color in general, for disabled people as well, for, you know, has been horrific. You know, we've had something like 30 plus Oscar winners, people playing someone with a disability, and only two of those people were actually disabled. Mm. You know, so we have these very, very strange absences in diversity discussions. And then people will say, well, it doesn't matter. And it's like, well, let's try it and see if it matters, because I think you might get better stories being told if they're told with an authentic voice, someone who's actually been in that situation.
Or at least somebody who might advise on the story if they're not going to be part of it, giving you some kind of authenticity, as you say. Mm. 2016, Barbara Streisand's getting a great run out from us this evening, but why wouldn't she, given that she was the first woman to win the Golden Globes directing award? Here she is in an interview from 2016 on CNN, explaining to the interviewer Michael Pereira about where she thinks we are now, well, then in 2016.
Yeah, I'm surprised that we've not come a little farther. When I made Yentl, yeah, everybody was an actress directing. I mean, an actress being responsible for money, you know, that kind of thing. And yet today, what is it, 4% or 9% of women are directing movies? So, that's very disappointing. There is an idea that's an archetypal idea about women, especially women who want to be in control of their work. That, you know, they're, or somebody powerful like Hillary Clinton. Women are suspect. Hmm. It's been that
standard
way since the beginning of time. So, you know, even though so many countries have had women leaders, America, this would be such a breakthrough for women, I think. But you have to also, you know, think of women against women. There's women who are against other women. And that's sad to see.
Get your fingers off the button. It's Michaela Pereira. Okay, I misread it. It was my mistake. She is Michaela Pereira, the interviewer who was interviewing Barbara Streisand there. Why did I call her Michael? At any rate, I did. I'm speaking with Helen O'Hara this evening about her book, Women versus Hollywood, rather, The Fall and Rise of Women in Film. It's kind of depressing to think in 2016 that Barbara Streisand was still saying, you know, we still really haven't got that far. How has Me Too, how has that movement affected things? Hopefully you're going to tell me some way positively, Helen O'Hara.
I am. No, I am. I think it's really helped. So, I mean, first of all, in terms of, you know, women kind of breaking through, we're now seeing women get hired for directing big, big blockbuster movies, which did not happen before. And I think the key for that was actually Wonder Woman being a huge success in 2017. But the other thing that happened, of course, in 2017 is, as you say, Me Too. And I think that's gone to Barbara's other point about women not supporting women, because I think there's been this perception in Hollywood that it's a zero-sum game. You know, if one woman gets a role, then that means there's one role less for everybody else, because there were so few roles for women, really good ones, you know, nuanced ones. And so every A-list actress saw herself as being in competition, essentially, with every other one. And I think that's changed since Me Too, because they all got together during that time. There were so many phone conversations and behind-the-scenes meetings and kind of powwows. And it led to the Time's Up response, the setup of that organization to help women everywhere fight against sexual harassment. But it also led to them realizing that they could do more together than against each other. And you started getting way more women producing projects, not just for themselves, but for other women to star in as well, and to look for, you know, shows that they could do as a group of women together. And you get things coming out of that, like Big Little Lies or Little Fires Everywhere and things like this, you know. So I think they're really beginning to almost mobilize as a group. And I think that is going to change everything.
And that's coming together and working as a unit, but in union with each other, really. But outside of that, is there still a seething resentment from the establishment underneath all of that? I mean, I'm pretty certain there are a bundle of people trolling right now about us talking about women versus Hollywood. Mm. Is there still a seething resentment outside of trolling, you know, at an actual establishment level?
Yeah, there is still resentment. You still get, like, male directors, for example, at the Directors Guild of America have seriously suggested that they should in some way be compensated for any efforts to promote women directors, even though women directors are under 10% of jobs at the moment, you know. Mm. And they have genuinely, they've acted like work is being, that is rightfully theirs, is being taken from them, which is, you know, which is not the case. If they're good enough, I'm sure they'll still get the jobs. So there is a little bit of resentment. There is a little bit of backlash. You know, you hear all these people often saying, has Me Too gone too far?
Yeah.
Well, most of the men identified are still working. So, you know, probably not, I would suggest. And none of the structural changes that needed to come out of that really have happened so far. So there's still a really long way potentially to go from that.
What about me and you, and when we can buy a cinema ticket again? Mm. What can we as cinema goers do to help this situation, to move things forward?
Well, a big one is vote with your wallet. You know, go and see the films made by women, starring women, you know, early on in their run, and not just women. I do want to be clear, you know, underrepresented people generally. If there's a film starring, you know, I don't know, some Latino people, go see that. Mm. If there's a film starring disabled people, check that out. You know, be adventurous, try new stories, because I think that is what will shift the needle in Hollywood. What they respect is money, and they're seeing already, you know, with hits like Wonder Woman, with hits like Black Panther, that diversity actually does pay off, that people want to hear new, fresh stories. So if they see that consistently, then that is going to shift the needle towards more equality overall.
Follow the money and money talks.
Follow the money.
All of those cliches. Helen, lovely to speak with you this evening.
Thanks so much.
That's Helen O'Hara talking to us about her new book, Women versus Hollywood, The Fall and Rise of Women in Film. It's published by Robinson. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. Tomorrow night sees the return of Emmy Award winner and Oscar nominee Bryan Cranston to our screens with his first leading role on television since Breaking Bad came to an end in 2013. Your Honour stars Cranston as a respected New Orleans judge who puts everything on the line after his teenage son is involved in a hit and run. Cranston is a familiar territory here, I hear you say, playing a good man who goes to extraordinary lengths to protect his family. But is Your Honour another triumphant role to add to the one of the best CVs in the business? Chris Wasser is here to cast his eye over Your Honour and give us his verdict. This is a remake, actually, Chris, Your Honour.
It is a remake, Sean. Yep, it's essentially an American cover version of an acclaimed and award-nominated Israeli drama called Kavodo. And that series told its story over two seasons, whereas this one is kind of advertising itself as a mini-series. Every episode kind of crosses the hour mark. It was, I think the original was, you know, 22 episodes in a season, half an hour at a time, told between 2017 and 2019. But I should note, I've never seen Kavodo, but also neither has Bryan Cranston. And he has been talking recently about the fact that he didn't really think it would be helpful. And I agree with them as well, because this works the same for the viewer, to watch another actor play the character who you're preparing to play. And I think that's an advantage going in for the viewer too, because if you had seen the original, sometimes you're going to be disappointed either way. So this is Peter Moffat, the English playwright and screenwriter, giving the Israeli story an American remake, basically.
And let's face it, by setting it in the city of New Orleans as well, he brings up lots of the things I've just been speaking about with Helen O'Hara. In fact, this idea, diversity is everywhere, and different communities rubbing up against each other, which is very much at the heart of the story that's been told.
Absolutely, yeah. Peter Moffat, he is essentially, despite the fact that he's British and despite the fact that he's white too, he is holding up something of a microscope over contemporary America, you know, the socio and economic tensions at its centre, racial divide. And he is telling a story that is frighteningly topical at times. So we've got Hunter Doohan, sort of a newcomer on the rise, playing the part of Adam Desiato. And he is a 17-year-old white high school student who he's on his way out one day to leave flowers at the scene of his mother's death. Now, we don't know much about his mother's death. We'll learn a bit later that she was murdered, but at this time it's a bit of a mystery. And he's in this predominantly black neighborhood, and a couple of guys approach him. He starts to get a bit panicky. Then he starts to be, you know, he's being followed in a black Range Rover, and all of a sudden his asthma kicks in and he has an asthma attack. And while he's reaching for his inhaler, he takes his eyes off the road, and unfortunately he knocks down a guy on a bike. Now he flees the scene. That's the basic premise, that he just completely panics. He goes home, he washes his clothes, he's just in another state of shock. And he tells his father when he gets home, and his father is Michael Desiato, who, as you said at the top there, this prominent, honourable judge played by Bryan Cranston. He tells his father, you know, Dad, I killed a man. And his dad is fully prepared to hand him in to the authorities, but it's only after he brings him to the police station that they realise who he's killed.
Yeah, well, we'll come back to that in a minute, but let's hear that moment when the father, Bryan Cranston as the father here, is talking to the son, and he's working out, look, let's work out what's happened here. The son has asthma and got into a right panic. So he's thinking, legally, maybe we can find our way through this morass.
You were driving and you couldn't breathe, right? And you were distressed, yeah?
His head must have... There was so much blood.
Okay, so this was a full-blown asthma attack then?
Yeah.
Okay, and you grabbed your inhaler too.
I couldn't find it.
Okay, so you couldn't breathe, you weren't thinking, and then the shock of what happened, but you stopped, didn't you? You stopped, and you got out of the car, and you tried to help him, but then you panicked, and is that right, Adam?
Yeah.
Okay, now listen to me. Listen to me very carefully. I love you more than anything in this world. And I promise you, it's going to be all right.
Yeah, you'd feel safe in the hands of a daddy like that, wouldn't you? Michael, the judge there, Your Honour, played by Bryan Cranston, going through the accident with his son, Adam Hunter-Doohan. I must say, very, very strong scene that, Chris, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the opening sequence. There's a bit of chat, there's a courtroom scene at the beginning, and I'll come back to a scene from that shortly. But there must be a good 15, 20 minutes then when there's practically no dialogue, just the car, and you're just waiting for something to happen. There's a motorbike in one part, we're cutting to a motorbike, we're cutting to a car, we're cutting to a motorbike, and you know, this is not going to end well. But it really is without dialogue for a long, long time.
Yeah, and it's brilliantly done, because the rest of the series, I mean, we were given 4 episodes to watch in advance, Sean, and it turns out that it's quite novelistic in scope and tone, and it branches out into various subplots. But for that first hour, if this was the pilot, you can see, especially in the first 15 minutes, as you mentioned, why this thing was commissioned, because it's wonderful storytelling without, you know, actors spouting dialogue that maybe doesn't make sense or that they wouldn't really say. It's just the building of tension, the setting up of the characters, the scenes, the mystery unfolding. There's so many questions that you want answered, but you know that this is going to take, you know, its time. Unfortunately, it takes an awful long time, but we'll come back to that, in kind of explaining itself. And it is masterfully done, because when you hear that scene where Cranston's character is talking to his son, I think that's the first time that anyone's talked in ages. It comes after a scene where Adam's trying to clean his clothes, and I should add, Sean, that first episode it did what it was supposed to. I had my stomach in knots watching.
Yeah, I was really tense watching. It reminded me of the film Drive. You know the way there are sequences in that film with just the car going down the street, not always at speed.
That's very true.
You know, it had a very similar quality, and that kind of the building of tension that was very, 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 very effective. But racial tensions are very much at the heart of this. And you say, you talked about the writer here, Peter Moffat, wanting to make comment on American society. It opens in a courtroom with the Bryan Cranston character in action. Let's have a listen to that scene. What's important here is that the woman who is being charged is a black woman, and it's a white police officer who's on the stand being questioned by Cranston's judge.
Do you know why they call him a shotgun house? You could stand at the front door and fire a shotgun straight through to the back door and out. Isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
All the rooms, living room, kitchen, bedrooms, and bathroom are off the side of the hallway. I mean, it's a clean shot. All the way, front to back. Pew. You sure you're sticking with the answer that you gave me? I stood at the doorway at 5700 Flood Street, just as you did. The same front door that you just testified under oath that you saw Famale Jones in the bathroom put a drug wrap up inside herself. Now, here's my question. Do you have see-around corner eyes? Or are you a liar of the vilest kind?
That's like a scene from a different film. That's like a scene from a courtroom drama from, you know, television in the 1970s, Chris Wasser, or indeed, you go back to Kill a Mockingbird. It's that type of feel of it. That's Bryan Cranston in Your Honour, which is the TV series starting on Sky Atlantic tomorrow night that Chris Wasser is speaking to us about this evening. It's a very different film, isn't it? Or a very different series, almost.
It is. And those scenes in the courtroom, to be honest, Sean, I don't mean to be unfair, but, you know, my eyes rolled so far into the back of my head, I got spasms in my back. Those scenes didn't work for me because they felt as though they'd been written by Aaron Sorkin. What I mean by that is we're watching real people played by great character actors who are saying things that real people never would. And that scene, although it needs to work out in the favor of the black woman who is, standing trial, and, you know, she later comes back into it and her teenage son becomes involved. It needs to work in her favor, but the things that the judge does, it's just not realistic, which is an awful shame because the guy who put this together, Peter Moffat, he has been known for British-based crime dramas, and this is his first time working in actually an American production and an American writer's room, and he tried to make it authentic as possible. He previously worked as a barrister, but I found that these scenes, they didn't really get to the heart of anything, and they didn't really provide any fresh insight. I mean, it's like I kind of compare Your Honor in a way to last year's The Undoing, another crime drama with, you know, that aimed for prestige television territory. It had Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant in it. Yeah. And it just skims the surface when it comes to offering any sort of insight into a corrupt police system in America, racial tensions, the fact that young men are pulled over every day and arrested for just basically running a red light or for having a broken light.
Yeah, but that was a hugely successful. Undoing was hugely successful.
Oh, it was, and this will follow suit. There's just some terrible gaps in the storytelling. I mean, I think Cranston, once you get past that first episode, which I think we both really loved, it starts spinning plates. And once I got to episode 4, I thought, why is this taking so long to tell the story? And the answer is because it was commissioned for 10 hours of television. I think if you cut this back to 5 hours, you would have had a terrific miniseries with no filler, with no waiting around, cut back on some of the subplots. But I should add, Bryan Cranston here, I would sooner take an average Bryan Cranston drama than no Bryan Cranston drama. He is really terrific here. And as you said at the top too, he's playing a character that we've seen him do before, but it's by no means stale at all.
Chris, don't say what is revealed at the end of episode 1, because I think for people who will watch that episode, it's better for them to see that happen. But we have a serious baddie here. You tell me who the actor is who plays the baddie, because Cranston's character is going to be in real trouble up against this guy.
Yeah, he is. And if you know his face and if you know the name, then you'll know what sort of character he's going to play. His name is Michael Stuhlbarg. He first came to prominence after he landed a lead role in the Coen Brothers joint, The Serious Man, back in 2009. And ever since, he's kind of been in demand as one of America's favourite character actors. I love this guy. I think he is a gift. He has been in everything from, you know, The Shape of Water to The Post. He played Arnold Rothstein on Boardwalk Empire. He played Mr. Perelman in Call Me By Your Name. If you've seen Boardwalk Empire and if you've seeing Call Me By Your Name, all I will say without giving anything away is that it's almost as though he combines those two characters, believe it or not.
And other standout cast members.
We have Carmen Ejogo in there as the former protege of the judge. I thought Hunter Doon was actually quite impressive, even if his character gets a little bit more annoying as it goes along. I thought Isaiah Whitlock Jr. from The Wire is terrific here. It is a great ensemble piece, and it's so busy, Sean, that sometimes it feels as though Bryan Cranston is actually a supporting player in his own series. So I can't fault the cast. I can't fault the ideas and ambition. I'm looking forward to continuing this. I just wish it didn't take so long to tell a very short story.
10 hours is that's a big commitment to television these days, at any days. All right, Chris. So you'll watch, but you kind of wish it would move a bit faster. Is that a fair summation?
Yeah. That is a fair summation. Put it this way, I will be going to episode 5 tomorrow when it comes on their TV. But you know, I'm also, I still wish it would just hurry up, Sean.
All right, Chris Wasser and Your Honour premieres on Sky Atlantic this Tuesday at 9 p.m. and all episodes streaming on Now TV from tomorrow. And that is our lot for this evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Damien Chanel was in sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night. Oh, Iha Morach, Anocht, Shocked in the Gaelic.